Why did you decide to join the military?
I wanted to do something that other people don't really do. Kind of always grew up a little on the adventurous side. My dad was in the Army for 24 years, so yeah, I grew up in that environment. And yeah, I pretty much saw it going two ways. Either I could go to college and not really have a plan, and then eventually reach the same conclusion and drop out of college and join the military, or I could just sidestep all of that and go right in.
What was your transition like from the military to school? What were the differences and similarities?
Going to school wasn't actually that bad. I got out in February or March of 2013, and that summer I worked as a camp counselor. So that was really my transition into civilian life. And that was, there are actually a lot of similarities, believe it or not, between being in the military and being a camp counselor. A lot of long days, somewhat, you know, Spartan living in a cabin with people who don't smell very, very good. And then, being exposed and like forced to live with people who really don't have the same experiences as me. It was different, but you know, nothing I couldn't handle. And then going to school. I didn't go to UW right away. I went to MATC. Applied for UW, didn't get in, and then took the next best thing, just to live in Madison. And yeah, that wasn't bad. There's a lot of older students there, a lot of veterans, so that was a pretty smooth transition.
So then why did you decide to attend UW-Madison?
I wanted to be a Badger. Yeah, my brother went here. I knew I wanted to go to school. I really had no allegiance to any other area. Wisconsin's my home state, and you know, might as well go big and go to UW-Madison rather than a different, you know, school in the area.
While in Afghanistan, what was your job/assignment? And what did you do while you were there?
So I was in an infantry unit. I'll start from the top and work my way down. So my my battalion was deployed. They kind of broke the companies up. Companies maybe, I don't know an exact number, maybe 100 guys or so. Yeah, I don't know, don't quote me on that. But they broke the companies up. Further than, they broke down the platoon. Platoon is about 30 guys. They put my platoon with the district center, and we pretty much, you know, stayed on a tiny little base. It was about the size of this room, actually. It was very, very small, and it was connected to the like the Afghan government like seat for that district center, and we pretty much were just there to kind of supervise and liaise with them. So, you know, if they were doing something then and they needed us, then, you know, we could help them out. We also had a handful of British guys there, some soldiers and some civilians, and they were kind of in charge of a lot of the civil projects that were going on. They were building a new pharmacy, a new school, I believe a new, like, clinic or a hospital, and then, so yeah, they would go out and check on those, but, you know, it wasn't safe to the point where they could just send two or three guys out to go and look at them. So if they needed, you know, people to go with them, then a squad of us would go out and make sure nothing bad happened to them.
And basically, you just get dark.
So you're more of like a security for the British?
Yeah, security for them, and also just the whole idea at this point was transitioning, the transition of power. So we couldn't just leave, you know, the Afghan forces there just to, you know, we couldn't just leave them there high and dry. So we had to, you know, have a presence there. And what that actually translated to was a lot of doing nothing. A lot of standing posts. There were there were posts, you know, little guard towers, and we had to have two guys in each of them at all times. So a lot of what we did was, you know, stand 4-hour post and then be off for 8 hours, and then stand to another 4-hour post and then off for 8 hours, and occasionally go out on patrols. When we first got there, it was December of 2011, we pushed out maybe a patrol a day for about a week, and then, you know, that rotated through squads. So each person went on maybe two or three foot patrols. And that was just to establish a base, what's called a baseline, getting to know the area and figuring out what's normal for that area. And then if something were to suddenly change, then we would know that, you know, something bad might be happening. For instance, you know, there's always kids running around, always people, you know, just talking to us and stuff. And then if one day there was nobody around, that's a pretty radical departure from the baseline. And then we could be worried.
What were the relationships like between the Afghan people and American soldiers, and then the Afghan American the Afghan army and American soldiers?
So, as far as like the non-military Afghans, well, I'll back up a little bit. We did a lot of mounted patrols, and where we'd be in trucks, convoys of maybe 3 or 4 trucks, and sometimes, yeah, we'd go out to the projects and check on them. Other times, we'd go on resupply missions. And, yeah, December, January, February, we did maybe one of those every other day, if not every day. Yeah, going to bigger bases. One time, we had to go and pick up a British soldier from Scotland. He had a cool accent, but I had no idea what he was saying. So, yeah, I mean, little things like that. So yeah, I went on almost all of those. I was always up in the turret behind the gun. So I had a, you know, bird's eye view of everything. And I'd say about half of the villagers would just kind of watch us drive by. Some of them would, like, you know, they were obviously discontented. Some of them would flip us off. Yeah, had a few rocks thrown at me too. But for the most part, they just kind of, you know, it was nothing new that Americans were there. You know, we'd been there for about 10 years. So it was nothing new. I will say that the kids were very friendly. Yeah, they really liked us. They all spoke incredibly good English, too. And a lot of them spoke Spanish. Like, they very intelligent kids. And crafty. They would, whenever we were on foot patrols, a lot of times, you know, they'd just reach right into your pocket and, you know, grab all my Jolly Ranchers and run away. Yeah.
And what about, you know, the relations with that? Afghan soldiers.
Yeah, the soldiers. So we were stationed with, or the other people that were, they were pretty much just a security force for the district center too. They were called the NDS, National Directorate of Security. And we had some posts that were, we didn't stand post with them, but the posts were very close together so that they were basically the same post. And yeah, I mean, we weren't, there was one guy, his name was Bakir, B-A-Q-U-I-R, I think is how it's spelled. But, yeah, he spoke pretty good English, so every time, you know, I'd walk by him when he was on post or something, he would invite me to come and drink tea. So I would do that. I established a good working relationship with him. You know, he'd ask me about America, and if I had ever been in New York, he couldn't understand that I don't have enough money or time to just go and travel around. But... Yeah, so, you know, we would talk, we would learn about each other. I think that was kind of more the exception than the rule. A lot of times, especially on the enlisted side, we would just kind of, or all of my fellow Marines would just kind of tolerate them and not really try to learn. And just, yeah. That's kind of, it sounds bad, but that's kind of Marine Corps culture, is that even the coolest things, we'll find a way to complain about it.
But, like, the relationship between you guys wasn't, like, hostile?
Oh, no. It wasn't hostile. Okay. I mean, they would ask us a lot of times for, you know, water, or we had these little cans of caffeine drinks called Rippets, and they loved those. Everybody loved those. And I was drinking several a day. But, yeah, so they'd always ask us for Rippets and stuff, and we weren't supposed to give them to them, so eventually it just got annoying. Like, you know, we don't have enough to give you, you know. So at that point, the big buzzword there was by, with, and through. And I think a lot of politicians, a lot of generals use that phrase. And that's pretty much just, if we do anything, we do it, you know, by, with, and through the Afghans in order to foster the transition of power there. So even simple things like, you know, if one of them had a headache and I had a bunch of Tylenol, I really wasn't supposed to give them, you know, give them my Tylenol, because that's... You know, that's an American problem to an Afghan, or an American solution to an Afghan problem. You know what I mean?
Okay. And you wanted to, like, give them individualization, sort of.
Yeah.
Like their own power to do.
Right. We wanted them to go, you know, to the pharmacy that we were building and, you know, have them get their tablets, as they call them there. If it were up to me, you know, it's a couple of pills to make a headache go away, but I had to do what I had to do.
In your opinion and what you saw, did you think the Afghan army was ready for the transition of power?
If they weren't ready, they were very close to it. I had heard so many horror stories of just how incompetent the Afghan forces would be when I got there. So my expectations clashed with reality pretty hard. They weren't bad. There's not, I feel like there's kind of this expectation that everything has to be perfect before the American withdrawal. And, you know, that's simply infeasible. There's not going to be, I mean, Madison itself is imperfect, you know, and it's probably never going to be. In the military, we call that job security. There was one time there was a rocket that was set up and hooked up to a cord, I think. So somebody was able to fire a rocket at our base and be gone by the time we even realized that what happened. And, you know, while we were kind of confused and trying to figure out what we were going to do, they, you know, before we even kind of knew what was happening, they were all, like, up and out of their area and just, you know, running out of the street with their rifles, you know, half-dressed and stuff like that. So they, that's a level of professionalism and dedication that, you know, I wasn't really expecting, but I was very happy to see that. And then, you know, if we measure progress and their ability, you know, them being ready to take over by, like, an American metric, then they're never going to look like they're ready, you know? Because they just have culturally it's just a little bit different. They would, you know, if they went to a meeting, they would sit and, you know, 75% of the meeting would be, you know, talking about themselves and catching up. 25% of it would be scheduling the next meeting, and then that would be it. That'd be a day's work. So it's like, well, we didn't really get anything done. You know, by an American metric, yeah, it's absolutely right. We got nothing done. But, you know, that's, as far as, you know, with respect to their culture, that was a good meeting for them.
Okay.
And they had much more presence there than the Americans. And I think that's a good way of measuring it. You know how we have, you know, police cars and people rolling around as a, you know, a show of force. They would have essentially the same thing, but these little like pickup trucks. We called them Danger Rangers because they were just not armored. And, you know, yeah, I don't want to know what would happen if they got hit by a bomb. But, you know, we would see them all the time. There were, you know, maybe one out of four cars on the road was a government vehicle. And those were, yeah, I mean, there's a whole alphabet soup of what units were the ones that were actually doing patrol. Afghan National Army, that's the big one. There's another, ANCOP, I don't really know what that stands for. ANP, Afghan National Police. Like, there's a huge presence.
So just to clarify, you said, you mean that in Afghanistan they had more of a presence, of an Afghan presence, than we do in America, or just in Afghanistan there was more Afghans than Americans?
Right. Both, I guess. There was more, you would rarely see, if you would see an American patrol out, they were out there for a purpose. Usually they resupply, or there were some kind of, I guess, special units that would go out and walk around, and I don't know what they were doing, but they were out there not just to be out there. The Afghans, on the other hand, were doing just, you know, beat patrols like you would expect a policeman to do here. And yeah, I mean, I guess the numbers there too, you know, the per capita, you can go an entire week without seeing a police car here, but yeah, maybe 5 minutes in Marja, Afghanistan, where I was, and you didn't see an ANA truck, it'd be weird.
When your time in Afghanistan, did you see, like, an impact or influence of like American training while you're there, or like equipment or tools or anything?
Well, they were building the school and the pharmacy and the clinic. I wasn't super involved with that other than walking there every once in a while. So, yeah, there were those. As far as training goes, at this point they were supposedly to have already been trained. So our purpose there wasn't to train them, just kind of, you know, be the American faces there. And they started, when we were getting ready to go home, I think the scheme was there, and I mean, don't quote me on this either, but I think the scheme was that everything was going to be reduced by 2/3. So if a battalion was there in that area, when that battalion left, one company would take over, which is roughly 1/3 of the battalion. And when my platoon left the district center, we actually turned that entire area over to, I think this was ANCOP. So the Afghans took over that entire base. The next closest Americans were, I guess, right down the street, but in much smaller numbers. So yeah, the transition was going pretty good, I think. That's a pretty huge tangent.
No. Why do you say they're supposedly supposed to be trained? Are you saying that because you didn't think they were trained, or that's just the assumption?
Well, in my opinion, they weren't bad. This was NDS, though. This wasn't just run-of-the-mill ANA. So they were, I mean, one guy, Bakir, the dude who I knew, and he likened himself to the CIA. And I was like, that's good, you know. I didn't really have the heart to be like, no, I think you're a little behind. But so yeah, these guys were the better ones, and they were all very ardent patriots. You know, I asked them the same thing, like, why be in the NDS? And they're like, oh, I want to be a part of the future of Afghanistan. Like, oh wow, that's incredible. I didn't meet very many ANA guys. I don't know if their answers would be the same. I feel like a lot of them, I mean, I can't back this up, but I feel like a lot of them joined either, you know, for money or a way to get out. I'm sure there are, you know, the patriotic feelings too, but probably not as much as in the NDS. As far as the training, though, again, it goes back to the cultural thing. In the Marine Corps, being safe with your personal weapon is priority zero. It's such a high priority that nobody even acknowledges it as being a priority. So it's always unsafe. You know, you always carry it with the muzzle pointing down, and you carry it in a certain way to make sure that if by some act of God that it goes off, the bullet's just going to hit the ground. So these guys would carry the weapon by the magazine. I have a picture, and I can email it to you. There's Bakir, actually, is standing with the magazine draped over his shoulder like this, and he's holding onto the muzzle like that. Yeah, I mean, it's probably a more comfortable way to carry it, but not safe. So, I mean, looking at things like that, it's easy to be like, you know, wow, some instructor was not doing his job when they taught these guys weapon safety. But, yeah, when the rocket hit and they all ran outside, you know, safety be damned, they just kind of went for it.
What were some of your memorable experiences in Afghanistan?
Yeah, when we first got there, we flew in, we got to a big base. I mean, thousands of people. There was a bus system and huge chow halls and restaurants and stuff. We stayed there for a little bit, and then we flew into a smaller base called Fob Marja. And then from there, we took a couple of trucks down to the district center, and it was not very far away at all. No, we didn't. I'm sorry, we didn't fly into Fob Marja. We flew into El Paso. So yeah, maybe about a 20 or 30 minute truck ride, and just like, just the culture shock of it all. And we had been in training where we had role players, actual Afghan nationals who had immigrated to the United States, who, you know, they would be dressed in in the traditional garb and come out to our patrols when we were in training. And, talk to us. And they spoke English, but they pretended not to. So I'd have to talk to my translator and be like, tell this guy not to walk down the middle of the patrol and go around. And then be like, you know, why can't I walk here? So, I mean, I thought that was culture shock. Like, oh, man, here's this this Afghan dude, and he's talking to me, and this is weird. And then actually getting there was like, I mean, the training prepared me a little bit, but this was like, whoa, you know, we're here. This is cool. Yeah, that, and I loved going on the patrols. This was compared to, I mean, I had been, a lot of the guys that I was with had been with that same unit the previous year when they deployed. And the environment there was way more hostile. So they would, you know, they saw a lot of combat then. My deployment, there wasn't much. I mean, there was that one rocket hit, and then a few ops that, you know, could have been bad, but they really weren't. But then, I liked going out and seeing all the people. And then the kids, like, I don't know what books they're reading, but they were just incredibly smart and knowledgeable. Like, they knew everything. One kid ran over to me with, like, a toy phone and said that, you know, and he said the sergeant major's name and told him that he was on the phone with me, or on the phone for me. And I was like, how do you know this guy's name, you know? And that was like, you know, it was just a run-of-the-mill joke to him. Like, they publish all this stuff in a newspaper and you just sit and read it? I don't know. It was weird. Oh, yeah, and then we did some ops and stuff. We went to the one that I went on, a platoon one on Moray, was left behind for some reason. They didn't like me. But we went on one, and it was like a vacation area for the Taliban. So if they, you know, wanted to get away from the cities for a little bit and go and relax, they would go out to this this area that was in a valley. And my entire platoon was spread out, pretty much just formed up in a line, and we just pushed through this valley. And there was a wheat field on this side, and then, you know, over here where I was like, you know, rocks and dust. And then a bunch of huts, or not huts, but compounds, dotting down the middle. And that was the first time Americans had been there since 2001. So there were, you know, kids running out that had never seen an American before. And that was the first American that they had seen. So a mixture of curiosity and more curiosity.
And you went on that to show, like, American presence?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For any... Okay. With your time in Afghanistan, do you believe you were successful at completing your assignment of, like, showing American presence?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's hard to measure, but I think it was. I think we did more good than harm.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
I don't know.
When you said you gave out supplies, you gave it to Afghan soldiers or American soldiers, and, like, what was in the supplies? Does that...
Resupplies.
Yeah,
resupply. Yeah. Oh, okay. We would since we were just our platoon and just like a small area, you know, we couldn't really keep a whole bunch of stockpiled supplies there.
Okay.
I mean, that's just not quite how it worked. So we'd we'd go out and pick up stuff for us.
For yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the food there was actually not bad. We had a cook. And that was his full-time job, and he was supplied to us from the regiment. And he would spend all day slaving away making making us some chicken or whatever. And then we had a lot of just like drinks and stuff. We had a big refrigerator, like one of the industrial walk-in ones. So we were able to have, you know, cold drinks, non-alcoholic beer, which just kind of bums everyone out.
Were there, since the British were also where you were there any cultural tensions between American and British, or not really?
No, they kind of stuck to themselves most often. So if we all lived in one giant compound, there was the district center, there was the American area, and then there was a tiny little enclave between the two, and we called it Narnia, because you have to go through this little tunnel thing to get there. And each guy had, like, their own trailer with a shower and an actual bed and TVs, and they lived like kings on that side. And then every Friday they would invite us over to have, like, a barbecue. So they'd grill up some steaks and some, yeah, it's a barbecue chicken, and they had a projector, and they'd show a movie on the side of one of the trailers. Yeah, they were. I always liked them. I've always been kind of fascinated with the relationship between the United States and Great Britain. So, any chance I got, you know, and asked them pretty stupid questions. You know, what part of England are you from? Like, I'm from Northern Ireland. Oh, okay.
Do you know what the soldiers before you came? Do you know what they were doing there?
Pretty much the same thing.
The American presence?
Yeah. So they were, by the time we got there, they were very, very ready to go home. They were pretty complacent, to say the least. So they had been there probably since the summer. typically during the winter, there's not much fighting that happens. If there's going to be any fighting, it's going to happen in the spring. I want to say that it has to do with, like, the rotation of, like, crops. So if they're not, you know, farming and taking care of stuff like that, then they have more time to, you know, to fight. And plus, when it's cold outside, they don't really want to leave their houses. So, yeah, they had been there through, you know, the non-fighting season.
So pretty much all of the training of the NDS was done way before you came. Is that correct? And mm-hmm. the people before you and stuff?
Yeah.
Is that what you would say?
Okay. Yeah. We were, I don't know, I want to say there's always more training that you can do, formal or otherwise. I actually went to a short course before we left that was focused on pretty much how to train, you know, the indigenous forces if need be.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on, like, what you learned in that course?
Yeah, so it was pretty much don't make any promises that you can't keep. Kind of a funny story. I was there with my lieutenant, my platoon leader, and he, towards the end of the thing, like, the Afghan people there, again, these were actual Afghan nationals who had immigrated. One of them was saying, and he said this in Pashto, and, you know, it was interpreted by another Afghan, even though, I mean, that was unnecessary because they both spoke English, but just to kind of set the stage more. You know, by the time that this fake meeting was done, you know, they were like, so, you know, the Americans have agreed to supply us with ammunition and magazines for our rifles and a B-52 bomber. And the Afghans all, like, you know, clapped and cheered, and us Americans just looked at each other like, when we talk about a bomber, you know, a B-52, do we even have those anymore? And my lieutenant, who wasn't paying attention, you know, like, oh, people are clapping, so he started applauding too. And then the guy who was running it all was like, all right, you know, I don't know how you're going to do it, but you're going to have to get them a B-52 now. And he's like, what? You know, yeah, I mean, by cheering with them, you just acknowledge that that's what we were going to do. So, yeah, it was kind of stuff like that. Like, don't make promises you can't keep. Help them, but again, buy with and through. One of the squad leaders, and he's a very respected guy, very knowledgeable, he kind of equated it to, like, when you're younger and you're receiving advice from somebody, your pride kind of stands in the way and you don't take the advice until they're not there, you know? Like, my mom used to always say, just for example, like, she'd try to teach me how to do my laundry or something, and I'd be like, I don't need to know how to do my laundry. until I'm on my own, and then I'm like, all right, I'm going to learn how to do my laundry, you know. I couldn't really accept back then, you know, like, yes, Mom, this is something that I need to learn, because it's kind of a, your pride gets in the way. That's kind of how it is with the Afghans. So if we were like, if one unit was like, you know, do that, like wear your helmet this way, you know, and it fits better, they wouldn't do it until those guys had left. Then they'd be like, all right, hey, it does fit better. So then the relieving units would be like, you know, the guys who were just relieved said that they don't know how to wear their helmets properly, but they all are. I don't get it. So maybe that's not the same motivation, but that's kind of the result.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
I don't know. It was kind of cool too, like the like just being well, see, I came from security forces before that, so most of what we, I mean, we morale on those units is so low because people join out of high school with the intent, you know, they're going to be, you know, John Bazelon out there with bullets strapped to them and machine guns, and then you end up standing post and being like, you know, I'm like a show puppy here for this parade, and people are taking pictures of me. But, you know, we used to have to stand duty at parades in our dress blues, and that's where the belt came around like the top of my rib cage. So you have to have like a buddy, you know, put the pistol in there for you. And it's like, what good am I as a security guard here right now? So then I, you know, getting to Afghanistan and actually, you know, going months without a shower and sand is a permanent part of your skin. It sucks, but it's cool, you know. It's what we joined to do. And there are a lot of times, like, it was just straight out of the movies, but I'll be sitting around in the tent, like, some of us listening to music, you know, someone doing push-ups, and two guys wrestling and whatever.
Yeah. Were you bummed you didn't see any combat?
Yeah, actually I was. Me and a person who still is a good friend of mine, we played a game on the internet last night. Lives in Michigan now, but he me and him were up, we stood post together a lot, and we were like, you know, I guess it just wasn't in the cards, you know. It's not like we came here and we're like, man, the first gunshot that goes off, I'm gonna hide, you know. We were just like, you know, come on guys, let's do something. But it's kind of yeah, immature, I guess, for me to say, but yeah,
that's what you're trained to do.
Exactly.